Hear now the word of the Lord. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young woman to the best of place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. When the young woman went to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go in to the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God stands firm and sure forevermore. Beloved congregation of our Lord Jesus Christ, our text this afternoon, it opens with a rather curious statement that after the king's anger had cooled, he remembered Vashti and the way that he had responded to her rebellion. And we might find ourselves wondering, well, how is that possible? How could Xerxes possibly have forgotten about events which had been of such enormous personal and political significance? Well, the key to appreciating what's happening here is to know that Xerxes had had a while to cool his jets. And that's because there's actually a gap of several years between the events of chapter 1 and the events of chapter 2. And during those years, Xerxes had been a busy fellow. And what had occupied him during that time? Well, it was the business of making war on the Greeks. Now, as we learn this morning, that war didn't go very well for Xerxes. Though the Persians hadn't been routed, the Greeks had succeeded in fighting them to a standstill. And what we need to appreciate is that from a public relations standpoint, this defeat had been an absolute disaster for Xerxes. And here's the thing. It wasn't just a matter of returning home in disgrace. Xerxes had also come home broke, and so had everyone else who had supported him. You see, that's the thing about the way that wars were fought in the ancient world. The only way to pay for everything was by plundering your defeated foes. Xerxes and his nobles, they had raised and supplied their armies through a combination of taxation and personal investment, and that meant that they had invested both their own wealth as well as the wealth of the empire in Xerxes' ill-fated venture against the Greeks. And they had done so because they not only expected to win, they had expected to profit. They had invested in Xerxes because they expected to recoup their costs. Indeed, they expected to profit handsomely by plundering the Greeks. The trouble, however, is that you only get to plunder when you win. And the upshot of Xerxes' defeat then was that nobody got any glory and nobody got any gold. And that was a huge problem. It was a huge problem for an ancient king because gold and glory, those were the two most important things that kings were expected to provide for their subjects. Which meant that by the time Xerxes got back home to Susa, his approval ratings had tanked. And he was a very grumpy king who was decidedly on edge. And it's in this context that Xerxes remembers Vashti. And let's be clear, his calling to mind of the past, his remembrance of Vashti, it wasn't born out of any sense of regret. It wasn't born out of any sense of fondness, nor was Xerxes motivated by loneliness. After all, narcissists like Xerxes can't be lonely. They've always got themselves. And it wasn't for want of physical intimacy either. There were many other ways for Xerxes to satisfy those desires. And that might leave us wondering, well, if those weren't the motivating factors, what was it that suddenly sparks Xerxes' desire to find a queen? Well, the key to answering that question is to recognize something very important about being a king in the ancient world. While any woman could provide you with company or with sexual satisfaction, there was one thing that only a queen could give him. And the one thing that only a queen could give him was a legitimate heir. And knowing that, it helps us to appreciate that Xerxes was acting entirely out of self-interest here. Now, to help make that clear, I want you to imagine something for a moment. I want you to imagine that you are Memucan. We talked about Memucan this morning. He was one of those advisors, and we hypothesized that maybe his marriage wasn't the happiest. Imagine that you're Memucan, and imagine that your king has just returned home after being soundly defeated in a war that he began. And it's not just that he's being disgraced, he's also being impoverished. And as a result of investing in him, so have you. Now, understandably, you are upset about these circumstances. And in your anger, you begin to wonder if you might be better served by a more capable ruler, one who could actually make good on his promises to provide you with glory and gold. And as you are stewing on these thoughts, it suddenly occurs to you that the king doesn't have an heir. You suddenly remember that Xerxes had put Vashti aside. And one of the consequences of that was that he had put aside all of the children that he would have had with her. Which means that hypothetically, if something were to happen to Xerxes, perhaps he would fall down a flight of stairs, or maybe he would have a hunting accident, or maybe he might eat something that disagreed with him. If Xerxes were to have such an accident, there would be no one waiting in line to inherit the crown. And without an heir, now the crown would be up for grabs. And in such circumstances, couldn't a well-positioned individual perhaps grab hold of power and glory for themselves? And suddenly what we realize is that Xerxes was motivated to remember Vashti because everybody else had remembered Vashti. He looked around at all of those advisors that he'd once trusted, and he sees the predatory look in their eyes, and he'd come to the stunning realization that if he was going to survive this situation, he needed a queen, and he needed a queen right now. But while this mighty ruler is capable of seeing the problem, he isn't capable of formulating a solution. And so once again, he turns to his advisors for direction. Though this time we do have to give Xerxes just a little bit of credit, he deliberately bypasses his senior advisors and he seeks out the counsel of the young men at court. Xerxes may have been a narcissistic tyrant, but he wasn't a complete dullard, and he knew better than to expose his belly to the other alpha males in the kingdom. And these young courtiers, they're not stupid either, because they see this opportunity for what it really is. It's a chance to advance their own cause by marrying one of their sisters or marrying one of their daughters into the royal family. After all, if you can't be king yourself, the next best thing is to try to make sure that you have the king's favor. And what better way to do that than by making sure that one of your own children or one of your own family members becomes the queen? But here's the thing. You've got to be careful. Because a narcissist like Xerxes, he can smell self-interest a mile away. And they don't want to spook him. So what these young men at court do is they cloak their true intentions by suggesting that Xerxes conduct an empire-wide search for a new queen. They say to Xerxes, let's look in the whole of your 127 provinces. Let's find all the most beautiful women. Let's bring them here to Susa for your pleasure, and you can choose one of them as a queen. But they make this suggestion knowing full well that historically the Persian kings had a long established practice of choosing their queens from families with the most illustrious Persian bloodlines. And so these young men at court, they never imagine, it never enters their thoughts, not even for a moment, that a foreigner, let alone a foreigner of lowly birth, might actually be a threat to their plans to seat one of their own on the throne. And so, brothers and sisters, as this chapter opens, once again, we see the most powerful man on the planet being played like a fiddle. His courtiers, they sense his fear, and they respond by inciting his lust. And predictably, Xerxes is delighted. He thinks this is a fantastic suggestion. And what follows can only be described as exploitation on a grand scale, as a group of young women are taken, and taken is most definitely the right word, because this was not a contest that they entered voluntarily. This was a contest that they were drafted into. It was a contest that they were dragooned into. They were taken from their homes, and they were effectively imprisoned behind the palace walls. And there, in splendid isolation, they were beautified, and they were trained in the sensual arts for over a year. And they endured all of this. They endured all of this so that for just one night, they could be escorted to the king's bedchamber and used for his pleasure, after which they would be consigned to live out the remainder of their days in the second harem, that second harem that's mentioned in the latter half of the chapter. Now, I can appreciate to yourself at this point, you're thinking, okay, Temple, this is all fine and dandy, but you gave us a history lesson this morning, and we're getting another one this afternoon. And is all this history really necessary? Well, brothers and sisters, let's stop for a minute, and let's just step back, and let's consider what we've learned, and let's apply it to the flow of the narrative so far. In chapter 1, we were introduced to the world of the Persian Empire, and we were brought to this Persian Empire at a time when it was at the height of its power and the height of its glory. And in that chapter, we were given a big picture view of Persian power and glory, and that was important. It was important because as God's people, we needed to be taught a lesson about how we are to view the kingdom of men as God's children. And now, in the opening verses of chapter 2, we discover that the camera focus has narrowed dramatically. Instead of looking at the whole of the empire, our attention has now been narrowed. It has now been focused on Xerxes' personal predicament, this issue of finding a queen. And that's intentional. God has deliberately narrowed our focus so that we are now staring directly into the heart of this empire. And he does so because he wants us to see that this empire is rotten to its core. And we need to see this. We need to see that there is a transition between these two chapters, between chapter 1 and chapter 2. Because whereas in chapter 1, what God does is to expose the limits of human power, here in chapter 2, he exposes the depth of its corruption. And exposing the depth of corruption in these kingdoms of men, it serves two very important purposes. First of all, it reveals to us the essential truth that the kingdoms of men are focused on feeding the lusts of men. The kingdoms of men are focused on feeding the lusts of men. Think of what we learned this morning. Far from serving the common good, this massive edifice of the Persian Empire, it existed to satisfy the needs and the desires of one single man. And there were no links that Xerxes wouldn't go to satisfy those needs. It's clear from these verses then that not only does the common good mean nothing to Xerxes, neither do individual rights and freedoms. Ultimately, if saving his bacon meant that hundreds of young women needed to be ripped from their homes, used for his pleasure, and then consigned to a lifetime of isolation and imprisonment, well, from Xerxes' perspective, that was just the cost of doing business. Their lives and their happiness meant nothing to him. But the truly staggering thing to realize, beloved, is that the entire system of Persian society supported Xerxes in the perpetration of these atrocities. And why? Because the people who inhabited Xerxes' empire were all desperately trying to become him. And so they're willing. They're willing not only to turn a blind eye to these abuses of power, they're actually willing to participate in them, all in the hopes that doing so will result in the advancement and the exaltation of them and their families. We need to see that. Xerxes stands at the pinnacle of a hierarchy, and absolutely everybody below him in that society is trying to claw their way up that pinnacle. They're willing to involve themselves in this atrocity because they want to have what Xerxes has. They want to be him. They want to become him. And so don't kid yourself, brothers and sisters. You can be sure that the moment after Xerxes agreed to this plan, there would have been a mad scramble as all the young men of court all raced home to try to figure out which of their sisters, which of their daughters was the prettiest. There were many, many young women who found themselves being offered up that night as their families sacrificed them on the altar of self-interest. And if we're honest, we'd have to assume that faced with the prospect of becoming queen, at least some of these women must have concluded that their virtue was a small price to pay for such an opportunity. And all of this drives home the point that the kingdoms of men are ultimately kingdoms of self. The kingdoms of men are ultimately kingdoms of self, which means that the most shocking discovery we make as we study these verses is that the Persian Empire was nothing more than the sinful heart of man writ large. And that the window that God has opened into the heart of this empire, it turns out to be a window that looks directly into the depths of our own hearts. For the truth is that the very same self-centered heart that beat within Xerxes, it beats within me as well. And the truth is that without the gracious intervention of God, I would pursue the lusts of the flesh just as Xerxes did. And so as we read these verses, God not only opens our eyes to the corrupt foundations of human power, he also moves us this afternoon here to confess, "There but for the grace of God go I." These opening verses, however, they also serve a second purpose. Because by means of these verses, the Lord is preparing us for another transition in the story. In chapter 1, he's given us a wide-angle view of the Persian Empire. In the opening verses of chapter 2, he narrows our focus down to a consideration of its heart. But then, in verse 5, our perspective shifts once again, and we're now shown what it was like to live as a citizen of that empire. We've seen the empire as a whole. We've seen the empire as its heart. And now we're going to see what it's like to live on the streets of that empire. More specifically, we're shown what it's like for God's children to live as citizens of that empire. And to that end, in verse 5, we're suddenly introduced to two Jews, Mordecai and his orphaned cousin Esther. And Mordecai and Esther, they were descendants. They were descendants of those who had been carried into exile by Nebuchadnezzar roughly a century ago. And for us, this shift in focus, it can come as such a welcome change. Because to this point, we've been dealing with powerful and perverted Persians, and their behavior has provoked both our laughter and our disgust. But now as we meet Mordecai and Esther, we're introduced to some hometown Hebrews. And we get excited. We get excited because we're going to read about some of our own people. These are folks who are on our team. But brothers and sisters, we can't lose sight of the fact that what we've read in verses 1 through 4, it's intended to prepare us to read and interpret the remainder of the chapter. And I really want to emphasize that this afternoon. What we read in verses 1 through 4 is intended to help us make our way through the remainder of chapter 2. And we need to appreciate this. And we need to appreciate this because it's possible that as we read through the remainder of this chapter, our enthusiasm can begin to wane as we read about the exploits of Mordecai and Esther. And I say this because our expectation is likely that amidst all of the immorality and all of the corruption of the Persian Empire, our hometown Hebrews, we expect them to stand out as shining beacons of purity and truth. But the trouble is that things don't seem to work out that way. In fact, what we discover as we make our way through this chapter is that it actually proves rather difficult to distinguish between the citizens of God's kingdom and those of Xerxes' empire. We've been hoping to find heroes, and what we've discovered are people who look more like conformists. Consider what we've been told about Esther, for instance. While Esther is undoubtedly powerless to resist being dragooned into participating in this travesty, once she is within the harem, her behavior can leave us feeling somewhat conflicted. Undoubtedly, for instance, the year-long process of beautification, it would have involved eating a diet of foods that was regulated by her Persian masters. And that diet would surely have included foods which the Jews were forbidden to eat. And yet there's no indication that, like Daniel, Esther tried to find some way to avoid becoming unclean. And then there's the fact that while Esther certainly hadn't chosen her fate, there's no way to deny that she excels within the world of the harem. And it appears that she did so not by standing out, but by fitting in. Consider how Esther wins Haggai's favor, and how she does so precisely because she is not only willing to get with the program, she's willing to follow it to the letter. And finally, there's the very uncomfortable fact that Esther ultimately wins this contest. And remember, brothers and sisters, the only way for her to win was for her to please the king, an unclean Gentile to whom she wasn't married. And not only did she have to please him, she had to please him better than any of the other young women had done. And again, the text provides no indication that, like Joseph, she shook off her cloak in order to try to flee from this. Joseph shook off his cloak to run from the house of Potiphar's wife. But there's no indication that Esther struggled to avoid this fate. In fact, the suggestion seems to be that when her time came, she went, and she went with the intention of winning. More troubling still is Mordecai's behavior. And we know from the text that Mordecai had become Esther's surrogate father, and he undoubtedly cared for her very deeply. And so it's understandable that he would want to protect her. But what are we to make of his insistence that she hide her Jewish identity? How could a faithful man of God ever tell his child to hide her light under a bushel basket? Given that God calls us to confess his name, and that God calls us to do so publicly and in all circumstances and regardless of the cost, how could Mordecai possibly tell Esther to conceal her heritage? Well, brothers and sisters, as we try to work our way through these feelings, it's very important for us to remember two things. We need to remember what the text does tell us, and we need to remember what the text does not tell us. First of all, in terms of information that our text does not provide, we need to remember that we aren't given any sense of what Mordecai and Esther were thinking and feeling as these events unfolded. We aren't told, for instance, what Esther's state of mind was as she was led to the king's bedchamber. Was Esther reluctant or was she eager? Was Esther remorseful or was she determined? We're simply not told. And the same thing is true of Mordecai. We're not specifically told, for instance, whether or not Mordecai had hidden his own Jewish identity. And we're not told precisely what motivated him to tell Esther to do the same. Was Mordecai a man of weak faith, or was he a man of sensible pragmatism? Again, our text simply doesn't tell us. What's notable, however, is that there is something else that we're not told. There's something else that's missing from this passage, and that is any form of praise or condemnation of their choices and actions. The author of the book of Esther, he makes no moral evaluation of their behavior anywhere in these verses. We are not told why they did what they did, and we aren't told whether or not the way they responded to their circumstances was laudable or reprehensible. All we're told is how they acted within the circumstances that they found themselves. But while there is certainly information that we have not been given, it's also true that we have been provided with precisely what we need in order to be able to come to grips with this text and to be encouraged by it. And in that sense, brothers and sisters, I'd like to point out two critical pieces of information that we are given in this passage. There are two things that we are told that are essential to understanding what's happening here. First of all, we are told where Mordecai and Esther are. And second, we are told that where they are is not where they are going to stay. We are told where they are, and we are told that where they are is not where they are going to stay. First of all, then, our text tells us where they are. And where they are is in Susa. Now, Susa was one of the two capital cities of the Persian Empire. It was the emperor's summer residence. More specifically, we're told here in these passages that Mordecai, he lived and worked in the citadel. Now, what was the citadel? The citadel was essentially a city within a city. You had the city of Susa proper, you had the whole thing. But then inside of Susa, there was a section of the city known as the citadel. And this was a district where the palace sat and where the king's officials were located. And this is then the site of the royal court. Xerxes lives in the citadel, and all of his counselors, all of his administrators, they live there as well. And Mordecai lives and works in the citadel. That's where Mordecai is. But we're also told where Esther is. And Esther has been drawn even deeper into this world because she has been brought into the world of the royal harem. She is inside the palace, and she is living in the sections of the palace that were reserved for the king's wives and concubines. And what we have to realize is that their location matters. And it matters because in terms of this entire kingdom of self, the self who ruled that kingdom exerted absolute control over these areas. There was nowhere else in the whole of his kingdom where Xerxes' power bore down more fully and more directly on his subjects. And that meant two things. It meant that the people who lived within the citadel, they lived within the confines of the glory and of the splendor and of the wealth of the Persian Empire, but they would also be the very first people to suffer from the exploitation and the corruption that flowed out of its corrupt heart. And it is within this context that our two hometown Hebrews are trying to survive. It's here that they are trying to live out the calling of all believers to be in the world, but not to be of it. And let's be honest, brothers and sisters, that is surely one of the most difficult challenges that we face as believers. And again, if we're honest, it's a challenge that we fail at, despite the fact that we live in a country like Canada. Ask yourselves this question. Would my neighbors be able to distinguish between me and the folks who live around me? Do I stand out in my neighborhood as a shining beacon of purity and truth? Or is it the case that I look pretty much like every other suburban Canadian citizen? And if we fail to distinguish ourselves, despite the fact that we live in a free and a democratic society, one that possesses a well-developed sense of individual rights and freedoms, if we fail to distinguish ourselves and to live as beacons of purity and truth in our world, are we prepared to cast stones at Mordecai and Esther for the choices that they made as they lived within the shadow of Xerxes' throne? It's so easy for us as we read these stories to imagine how brave we would be. How brave we would be if we were Mordecai or if we were Esther. We like to imagine that we would behave like Daniel. We like to imagine that we would behave like Joseph and that no matter what the cost, we would let our light shine for the Lord. But here's the thing, beloved, and I'm going to quote from an admittedly profane source here. As the infamous boxer Mike Tyson once observed, everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the mouth. Everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the mouth. What Tyson meant is that we all think we're champions, we all think we're heroes, until the blows start landing. And we've got to remember that those are precisely the circumstances that Esther and Mordecai were trying to survive in as God's children. And they weren't being punched by Mike Tyson. They were being punched by an empire. And being aware of where they are, it can help us come to grips with some of the choices that they make. Think, for instance, of Mordecai's command to Esther. He tells Esther as she enters the harem, don't reveal your identity. Don't let them know that you are Jewish. Mordecai made that decision as a man who lived in Xerxes' court, and he knew then what the consequences would be if Esther was not chosen as the queen. Understand, beloved, that the women who did not win this contest they would have been shut up for the remainder of their lives in that second harem that is mentioned in this text. And why? Because Xerxes could not take the risk that any potential children that might arise from these liaisons, that they would grow up to become a threat to his power. So these women, they would be taken, and they would be segregated away from the rest of the world. Well, I want you to imagine for a moment that you were dragooned into this contest. You're maybe 14 or 15 or 16 years of age, and you're ripped out of your home, and you're brought into this palace, and you don't win. You don't get to go home. You will be segregated to live in isolation for the remainder of your days, utterly ignored by the king, his court, and the world that moves on around you. And you will live in that isolation for the remainder of your days, and it might not be the natural remainder of your days. Because in the ancient world, when a new king came to power, one of the very first things that they would do is execute the harems of their predecessors. And those are the circumstances that Esther has been caught up in. Which means, brothers and sisters, that as we read this chapter, we need to stop thinking about this as being some kind of beauty contest. This isn't a beauty contest. It's a back alley knife fight. And when you are fighting for your life, you can't afford to give your opponents even the slightest advantage. And Mordecai knew that. He knew that because he lived within the world of Xerxes. He lived in the shadow of his throne. And Mordecai knew, he knew that within the world of the harem, information was power. And he understood that Esther couldn't afford to give her enemies any leverage because that could be used against her. And we need to remember that Mordecai would also have known what all the young men at court knew. Remember how we talked about this? Why had they come up with this plan of an empire-wide search to cloak their own interests? They knew that the Persian kings only chose wives from the purest of Persian bloodlines, so for them there was no risk getting women from around the empire. Well, Mordecai knew that. Mordecai understood that. And so the reality is he understood that if people in the harem were to realize that Esther was Jewish, that it could only hurt her chances. Now, brothers and sisters, that might not justify Mordecai's decision, but it sure does help to explain it. And we can see the importance of the shift in perspective that occurs between chapter 1 and chapter 2. Because it is easy to laugh at the power of men when you are looking down on the kingdoms of men from heaven. But it is a lot harder when you are sitting amidst the mud and the mire of life in this broken world. And so this chapter reminds us that living as God's children in this sinful, broken world, it's a hard and it's a messy business. And all too often, we aren't up to the task. We don't always make the right choices. And we don't always respond to our circumstances the way that we should. And the reality is that all too often, we prove to be pragmatists rather than heroes, conformists rather than witnesses. And the reason that this is so has everything to do with the heart that beats within us. The heart that beats within me, it's a sinful heart. It's a Xerxes heart. And that means that sometimes when I'm confronted by the hard decisions of this life, I don't know what to do. And sometimes even when I do know what's right, I lack the strength to follow through with those choices. Let me ask you a question this afternoon. Should Mordecai have told Esther to stand apart from the crowd by revealing her Jewish identity? Maybe. Perhaps she would have won the favor of Haggai the way that Daniel did. Or she might have ended up discarded and dead. Who's to say? Certainly not us, that's for sure. But the wonderful comfort of this chapter, the wonderful comfort of this chapter is that whatever the rightness or the wrongness of their motives and their decisions, Mordecai and Esther have not been left alone to fend for themselves in this world. And what this chapter reveals to us is the absolutely wonderful and incredible truth that where they are is not where they're going to remain. And that's because the sovereign God of history, he is watching over his people. He's aware of all of their struggles. He's aware of their strife. And he is working to ensure that they triumph over those circumstances, even if they don't know it themselves. And that's made clear to us. It's made clear to us in the way that this chapter ends. We're told at the conclusion of this chapter that Mordecai, he just happens to hear of a plot against Xerxes' life as he sat in the palace gates. And as we read those words, and as we read them with the eyes of faith, we realize that there is absolutely nothing coincidental about what happens here. For we know that even though he's not specifically mentioned in these verses, it is the Lord who has engineered, it is the Lord who has overseen these circumstances. It's the Lord who causes these words to come to Mordecai's ears. And as a master storyteller, God is letting us see something of his work in Mordecai's life as a kind of clue, as a kind of preview of coming attractions. It's as if the Lord is saying to us here at the end of chapter 2, get ready, keep watching, because I'm here. And you can be sure that I'm working to the good of my people, even in the midst of these sinful circumstances. But he's not just signaling to us that he is active in what's happening. He's not just providing us with knowledge of the fact that he is present. No, he is giving us an incredibly deep and an incredibly profound message of comfort. Because by ending this chapter the way that he does, God teaches us that his power and his grace are greater than the consequences of our sinful choices. It's true, God says. It's true that so often the way that you have chosen to navigate through life has proven to be both sinful and disastrous. And I know all too well, says God, what the dire consequences of your choices can be. But watch. Watch as I show you how my power is so much greater than your sin. Watch as I overcome and undo the sinful consequences of the choices that you have made. Brothers and sisters, we need to remember not just where Mordecai and Esther were. We also need to remember who Mordecai and Esther were. They were exiles. They were exiles who had been consigned to live in a hostile foreign land. Why? Because of the sinful disobedience of their ancestors. And they were not just exiles, they were also sinners. Sinners who so often had to bear the consequences of their own flawed and short-sighted decisions. But they were something more. They were also God's children. And so they would never be lost into the sin in which they had been born or into the sin in which they had cast themselves, which means that where they were wasn't where they would remain, because God would take them. God would lead them. He would lead them from where they were to where they needed to be. What he does for Mordecai and Esther, he will do for each and every one of his children. Perhaps you were wondering why we took a moment to read from Luke's gospel and why we read that particular account of the thief who hung on the cross beside Jesus. I want you to take a moment this afternoon and think about the trajectory of that man's life, the thief who hung on the cross beside Jesus. What lay behind that man? Every choice that that man had made had been both sinful and disastrous. He was a rebel, he was a thief, and he was a murderer. And now, as a consequence of those choices, he found himself nailed to a cross. And as he hung on that cross, a lifetime of sin, of disobedient choices, lay behind him. And yet in those final moments of his life, he acknowledged the truth of his circumstances. He turned to the other thief, and what does he say to him? He says, "Be quiet. Be quiet, because we are precisely where we deserve to be. Our actions, our choices, that's what led us to be here." But then he looked to Jesus, and there he saw the one who he knew would not leave him where he was. He turned to the one who could help him to triumph over all the sin that he had caused, over all the sin that he endured. And what does he do? He appeals to Jesus. And what is his appeal? "Lord, take me from where I am and lead me to where I need to be." That's why he asked Jesus to remember him as Jesus enters his kingdom. And how does Jesus respond? He responds with mercy. And he responds with the steadfast promise that his mercy was greater than that man's sin. That's why Jesus responds by saying to him, "Today, this very day, you will be with me in paradise." "Because you have hoped on me," Jesus says, "you may be absolutely certain that I will not leave you to suffer the consequences of your own sinful choices. Instead," Jesus says, "I will most certainly take you from where you are, and I will lead you to be with me." And just like Mordecai's story, just like Esther's story, this man's story was recorded that we might have hope. Perhaps you're here today and you look back on your own life, and all you see as you look back is disaster, destruction, hurt, pain, broken promises, sinful choices, deeply held regrets and wounds. Well, the gospel comes to you this afternoon. And the Lord says to us that in him there is hope. Hope that if we acknowledge our sin, if we acknowledge our shortcoming, if we turn to the Lord, he will not let us bear the consequences of our own sinful choices. Here in the gospel there this afternoon, there is hope. Hope that he will take us from where we are, and hope that he will lead us to be with him. Amen.